This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Hello, good afternoon. I'm David Brenner. I'm the Vice Chancellor of Health Sciences, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to our Health Talk series. I'm delighted we can get together, even if it's only by Zoom, although I want you to know I miss you all and I miss seeing you in person. For this talk, I'm excited to introduce two amazing colleagues, Dr. Ezra Cohen and Dr. Jyoti Mahadev. They're from the Morse Cancer Center. And as you all know, the Morse Cancer Center is the only NCI-designated comprehensive cancer center in San Diego. There are 14 cancer disease teams, including experts in every major subspecialty. These include prostate, head and neck, breast, lung, and GI cancers. We've really made a concerted effort to recruit, retain, and develop an amazing faculty at the Morse Cancer Center. Our physicians help decide the nation's guidelines for cancer care through our membership in the National Comprehensive Cancer Network. There are currently more than 200 active open clinical trials for new cancer therapies at the Morse Cancer Center. We have a team of over 1,000 physicians, scientists, researchers, and providers focusing on comprehensive patient care research. So I would first like to introduce Dr. Jyoti Mahadev. She's a radiation oncologist who specializes in treating gynecological and breast cancers. Her expertise includes intensity modulated external beam radiation, image-guided radiation therapy, and image-guided brachytherapy, which is advanced cancer therapy that involves placing radioactive implants inside or near the tumors. She also manages the care and treatment of cancer patients and works in close collaboration with other doctors in Morse Cancer Center, including medical, gynecological, and surgical oncologists. She is very invested in patients' reported outcomes and fostering an optimal patient experience during radiation therapy. Prior to joining us here at UC San Diego, she served as the brachytherapy director in the Department of Radiation Oncology at UC Davis Medical Center. She received awards for teaching and clinical expertise, including Educator of the Year and the Dean's Award for Gynecological Interstitial Brachytherapy. She was chief resident during her radiation oncology residency at University of Washington Medical Center in Seattle. She completed an internship in internal medicine and earned her medical degree at Case Western Reserve School of Medicine in Cleveland. So welcome, Jyoti, and we're interested in hearing your talk. Thank you.
It is my pleasure and honor to talk with you today about radiation and immunotherapy for cervical cancer. I'm Dr. Jyoti Mahadev, Associate Professor of Radiation Medicine and Chief of the GYN Radiation Medicine and Brachytherapy Service at Morse Cancer Center. Our main objectives at UCSD Morse Cancer Center is to really tackle cervical cancer and help patients. Our mission is better understanding of cervical cancer to better fight and cure the disease. In so doing, we've started to look at and use immunotherapy, which uses your own immune system to fight cervical cancer. Today, we'll talk about exciting trials that we have at UCSD, combining immunotherapy and radiation for cervical cancer. We'll also talk about our research and our goal and mission to help patients with their quality of life and survivorship. And unfortunately, we still see patients like this every day at Morse Cancer Center. Patients who come in with bleeding and pain due to cervical cancer. As you can see in the arrows, there is a large cervical cancer that's taking over a patient's pelvis, causing pain and bleeding. As we know, with cervical cancer, the vast majority is caused by the human papilloma virus. This virus causes almost all cases of cervical cancer, and more than 90% of Americans are at some point infected with HPV. But what we don't know is why certain patients clear the virus and why some patients go on to have cervical cancer. Radiation is a very effective tool against cervical cancer. As you can see on the left, there's a very large tumor that's circled in red, a large tumor causing pain and bleeding and suffering. After giving a course of radiation, chemotherapy, and brachytherapy, which includes implantable radiation sources, the tumor pretty much is completely gone. And it continues to baffle our treatment team as to why some patients respond so well, like this patient's, and why some patients don't respond. And it leaves us with many questions and goals for our research program. Were we just lucky when we cure patients? Are these patients representative of all patients that we'll see now and in the future? Will it be durable? Are our efforts going to be sustained? And how do we produce more survivors? How do we cure this disease, prolong patients' disease-free interval? And moreover, after treating patients with radiation, how do we help their quality of life and mitigate radiation side effects? Cervical cancer continues to have a devastating effect on patients in the United States. Despite all of our efforts with radiation and chemotherapy, only about 2/3 of patients who present with disease will live. And therefore, cervical cancer remains the second most lethal cancer in women in developing countries. About 1/3 of patients in the United States will die. Globally, 50% will die. And patients continue to present with disease in the lymph nodes and disease that causes their death. But there's very interesting and promising results using immunotherapy and radiation across all disease sites, including cervical cancer. And there's a lot of rationale for combining immunotherapy and radiation. The strategies include using immunotherapy during radiation, after radiation, or even before to kind of prime your own immune system or take the brakes off your immune system and help better fight the cancer. The cancer immunity cycle is well developed and known about. We know that our body and our immune system recognizes certain tumor antigens or tumor cells that are recognized by cancer-fighting cells within the body. And then these cells hone in to certain areas that will then fight the cancer. But cancers, as we know, are very smart. They have immune-resistant mechanisms, such as evasion or hiding from our immune system, inducing T-cell or immune system dysfunction, immune tolerance, where the T-cells may come to the party but then not really participate, and evasion. Now, radiation with immunotherapy can often overcome these mechanisms. We can help better infiltrate tumors with these immune-fighting cells and better hone in on tumors with better surveillance from our immune system. There's a certain class of drug molecules called immune checkpoint inhibitors, and these take the brakes off of a patient's immune system. When we combine these with radiation therapy, we can have potential optimal effects, potentially increasing the cure for cervical cancer and better allowing our own immune system to fight the cervical cancer. We did a seminal study years ago through the gynecology oncology group looking at a phase 1 first trial using curative patients with cervical cancer after standard of care chemoradiation followed by immunotherapy. This was funded by the National Cancer Institute and produced a lot of interesting data that will then be used in future studies. After enrolling 34 patients, we found that this regimen was very tolerable and had a good safety profile. Patients could tolerate it very well. And more so, we took blood from these patients and we learned that radiation in and of itself with chemotherapy increases one's own immune system and expresses something called programmed ligand death 1. Using these translational works, including blood and swabs, we then learned more about cervical cancer that then translated to our next study. Chemotherapy and radiation in and of itself stimulated the immune system and allowed for certain targets using PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitors that will be helpful moving forward. The National Cancer Institute then funded a second study that we have open right now at UCSD, where I'm the national principal investigator, looking at using an anti-PD-L1 or atezolizumab as an immune primer and concurrently with chemoradiation for node-positive locally advanced cervical cancer. In this study, we take biopsies from patients to learn more about the disease and how we can better target cervical cancer treatment options. Patients are given immunotherapy before chemoradiation and then are given two more doses during chemoradiation. We have another study open at UCSD that I helped form. This study is a global study looking at more than 760 patients, randomizing them to the standard of care, chemoradiation, versus chemoradiation and immunotherapy. We also are very passionate about patients' quality of life. We know that after a patient is cured, we want her to be able to go back to her normal ways of life as much as possible. However, the side effects of radiation can often change patients' quality of life. We're partnering with Dr. Frank Talke from the UCSD Mechanical Engineering Department and Dr. Milan Milake, a bioengineering specialist, to look at innovative solutions to try to prevent radiation-induced vaginal stenosis, which causes shortening and narrowing of the vagina after radiation for cervical cancer that can often cause pain or sexual dysfunction and emotional trauma for patients. We also understand that we want to treat patients holistically, and right now we're running every Tuesday from 3 to 3:40, I treat a meditation, mindfulness, and deep breathing class that aims and focuses on our cervical cancer patients, GYN patients, families across the UCSD network, and caregivers that often need some time to reflect on all the hard work that they're doing to take care of themselves. Thank you so much.
Jody, thank you so much. That was fantastic. I'd now like to introduce Dr. Ezra Cohen. Dr. Cohen is the new chief of the Division of Hematology Oncology and co-director of the San Diego Center for Precision Immunotherapy. He's a physician scientist and he leads a research team interested in mechanisms of action of novel therapeutics. He has made major contributions to targeted and to immunotherapy. Dr. Cohen's associate director for translational science and leader of the Solid Tumor Therapeutics Research Program at our Moores Cancer Center. He brings his expertise and preeminent reputation in head and neck cancer and research to solid tumor therapeutics. Dr. Cohen completed his residencies at the University of Toronto and at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He completed a hematology oncology fellowship at the University of Chicago, where he was chief fellow. Prior to his arrival in San Diego, Dr. Cohen was co-director of the Head and Neck Cancer Program, associate director for education, and program director for hematology oncology fellowship at the University of Chicago Comprehensive Cancer Center. Ezra, welcome and thank you.
Thanks very much, David, and thanks for allowing me to participate in this wonderful session. Thanks to everybody for tuning in on Tuesday to learn a little bit about immunotherapy. Hopefully I can do that. I will complement a lot of what you just heard from Dr. Mayadev and put things into perspective from a slightly different point of view. And what I've titled this talk is The Immune System is Telling Us How to Cure Cancer. Are we ready to listen? And realizing that that title may be a little bit provocative, but I think there's some proof that I'll show you in just a few minutes that, in fact, we might be able to do what was unimaginable just a little while ago, and that is cure metastatic disease with immunotherapy. So with that in mind, let's review a little bit of what you just heard, but the current approaches to cancer treatment that have included traditionally surgical therapy that we remove the cancer, radiation therapy that applies a specific energy to the cancer, and then as a medical oncologist, what I've used for many years, and that is chemotherapy, which is essentially a DNA toxin that works because cancer cells proliferate at a much faster rate, usually, than most of our other cells. But still, these are effectively poisons that we deliver to our bodies. Now, can the immune system help control cancer? And the answer, we think, is yes. And of course, there's proof in that. But let's talk about what the immune system really is. And remember that the immune system was designed to protect us from infections, from pathogens, and not really designed as a anti-cancer system or module, but we can use it to fight cancer, as I'll show you in just a minute. But let's talk about what the immune system is, and that it really has, the way we think about it, two arms, an innate arm that is responsible for that quick response, and then an adaptive arm that is responsible for longer term elimination. So the innate arm is always on. It reports and responds first and quickly. It recognizes features that are common to all pathogens or viruses and bacteria, and it is highly inflammatory. On the other hand, the adaptive arm requires time to learn and to be induced. It recognizes unique features of specific viruses and bacteria, and that's why we think that we can use it to fight cancer, because it's very specific. And it confers lifelong memory, as well as being specifically toxic to the cells that are infected, or in the case of cancer, that carry specific mutations. Well, why are we interested in immunotherapy, and what makes immunotherapy so compelling? It's illustrated partially by this graph here. And the graph is meant to show on the y-axis the percent of patients who are alive, and on the x-axis time. And this curve demonstrates what happens to a patient who has metastatic or advanced disease, that they live for some time, but unfortunately, that survival curve goes to zero. Now, with standard therapy, and that includes the therapies that I talked about at the beginning, we can shift the curve so that the average patient lives longer, which is a great thing, and in many cases lives better. But again, that number, as you draw it out in time, unfortunately goes to zero. What we are beginning to understand about immunotherapy, and Jyothi hinted at this, is that there are patients who have been exposed to immunotherapy who really should not be alive, especially years later, but we're noticing that not only are they alive, but they're free of disease. And what we call that is the tail on the curve. What we have not seen with conventional therapy is that tail on this curve that we are beginning to see with immunotherapy. So it is increased survival in a certain population of patients. But as you can see from this curve, clearly there's room for improvement. Now, to bring this into real life and into a case, this is the scan of a gentleman that we treated with immunotherapy. I don't know if you can see on your screens, but the date of the scan is 2016. This is a gentleman who was treated with one of the checkpoint inhibitors that Jyothi talked about, specifically pembrolizumab, and another drug called epacadostat. He was treated on a clinical trial, and what you don't see on this scan is cancer. This is a gentleman who had recurrent head and neck cancer that incidentally was HPV related, who really should have died of their disease, and yet we are here 4 years later, and in fact, this gentleman is Ricky Rocket, who's the drummer for Poison. Some of you may have seen this article or this slide in the past, and he is still alive, functioning completely normally 4 years after receiving immunotherapy, and is a wonderful illustration of what immunotherapy can do in some patients who really in the past, we would not have expected to be taking this picture years after their diagnosis of advanced or recurrent disease. And this is not true for head and neck cancer alone. It is now the case for many cancer types across the entire spectrum. And this slide is not meant for people necessarily to read and certainly not to memorize, but it gives you a flavor of how many cancers we have now that have an approval for immunotherapy. And it really is all parts of the body across the entire spectrum of disease. And immunotherapy is making such a great impact. But as I said at the towards the beginning, there's room for improvement, and we always are looking for ways to do more and to get better. And what I'll talk to you about are two therapies now that we've developed at UCSD in collaboration with colleagues, and that we think are going to move the field forward. The first is a personalized neoantigen vaccine, and you see not only the first patient to be treated on this treatment, on this therapy in the picture, that's Tamara Strauss, but my collaborator at La Jolla Institute, Steven Schoenberger, and another collaborator at UCSD, Dr. Aaron Miller, who's standing in the back. That the other person, by the way, is Tamara's mother, Iris. But what this therapy essentially does is it takes those antigens that Joyke was talking about before, those neoantigens that are a product of the mutations in a cancer, understands how the immune system is responding to those mutations. And what we've been able to do is bring those two elements together and create a vaccine that is truly personalized and created for just one person on Earth and one person at a time. And I'm happy to say that actually Tamara's done fairly well with this treatment and continues on the personalized vaccine. In fact, she's being treated now on this type of protocol that doses the vaccine three times up front and then continues it for a longer period of time in association with another immunotherapy, a checkpoint inhibitor called pembrolizumab. And that trial is continuing to go on at UCSD and again in collaboration with La Jolla Institute. And in fact, you'll meet a patient who's on the trial in just a few minutes who has now is now on the next generation or the next arm of the study that treats patients who don't have evidence of disease, and we want to prevent the disease from ever coming back. Well, we don't stop at vaccines. The other therapy that I really believe is cutting edge that I want to talk to you about is the creation of natural killer cells, another type of cell in the immune system that can be anti-cancer from human undifferentiated pluripotent stem cells. In other words, taking these stem cells that don't have an identity yet, they have not differentiated, giving them the specific factors and cytokines that they need to eventually become natural killer cells, and using those types of cells in collaboration with a local company called Fate Therapeutics against cancer. And as you can see here, we're doing it in the context of a few clinical trials that are open now at UCSD and another collaborator at the University of Minnesota. These are studies that are currently ongoing. And then the last thing I wanted to mention is that we're bringing all of this together in what we've called our precision immunotherapy clinic, where we're recognizing that we wanted to create a structure where patients could come to see us that are interested in immunotherapy. We could advise them on what the best treatments are, including immunotherapy, but not always, and try to tailor that therapy towards what the cancer is telling us and as much as we can learn about their immune system. And of course, as much as possible, provide clinical trials that would be appropriate for that patient. And so with that in mind, again, I'll thank you for the pleasure of presenting today. And I'll now introduce one of our guests, and Jackson Bick, who I believe is on the call or on the broadcast, and who's actually being treated on the personalized immunotherapy study. I think both Jackson and his mom, Deanna, are here. I'll just give you a little bit of a backstory very briefly. I've actually known Deanna for about 21 or actually about 24 years. In fact, Jackson and my younger son were born just 4 days apart. And by sheer coincidence, we ran into each other again and were presented with what Jackson was going through that he'll talk about, and had the opportunity to actually enroll him on the personalized neoantigen vaccine study. So with that in mind, Jackson and Deanna, I see that you're both on, and I'll let you do the talking.
Okay, thank you very much. I want to thank everybody at UC San Diego for letting us tell our story today. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Jackson's story first, and then Jackson's going to chime in. But Jackson's story began in November of 2018 when he was a sophomore at CU Boulder, and he was playing a game of beer die, and he noticed that while he was trying to catch the dice, that he couldn't see the upper half of his field. And so he called his father. Luckily, he called his father and not me, because I probably would have told him to call me back after he had gone to sleep that night and the game was over. But he called his father, and his father said, who's also a physician, get to the ER. It sounds like you have a detached retina, and I want you to get it checked out. I'll fly out, and you'll probably have surgery. So Jackson went to the ER, and the doctor referred him to an ophthalmologist who obviously saw the tumor in his eye, and then brought him to another ophthalmologist, because I think that he probably didn't want to tell a 19-year-old that he had a large tumor and cancer. When Jackson saw the retina specialist that evening, he sat him down and he said, Jackson, you have cancer in your eye. At which point, my husband said to Jackson, we're going to do a change of plan. You're going to come home. We're going to put on the full court press. And I happened to have been in a very remote part of the world at the time. I was an 8-hour drive from the nearest airport from an hour flight to Kathmandu. So 40 hours later, I was finally able to get home. And the next day we flew to Philadelphia to the Wills Eye Center to have radioactive plaque therapy on Jackson's eye, where he had a set of radioactive seeds put behind his eyeball and then a lead shield on top of it. It was closed. He was put in isolation for 6 days. And I have to tell you, it was probably the most terrifying period in our lives. All three of us were scared. We didn't understand the implications. They did a tissue biopsy at the time, and then they said they would do impact genetic testing. This type of cancer has two very distinct players. One is an okay player, but the other part of this cancer, the other type of this cancer, is very highly metastatic, over 85%, and untreatable once it's metastatic. And so very high risk. When we got the results of that genetic testing, we were not surprised to find out, because of the size of Jackson's tumor, that he actually was in the very high risk category. He had all three genetic markers that determined that he was in this category of highly metastatic risk. And his tumor size was actually 18.5 by 11.5, where normal tumors that they see initially are about 3 to 5 millimeters. So we were devastated at the time. We put him on an experimental chemotherapy in Philadelphia to try and reduce that risk by about 10 to 12%. But in the meantime, we sat around, talked softly about what the future may or may not hold for us. And Dan asked me if I would go to San Diego with him for a weekend. I said, fine, I'll go, but I'm not talking to anybody. I'm not seeing anybody. And when we got there, I said, you know, we should probably call our friend Ezra and just touch base and let him know what's going on. And when I called and explained what was going on, Ezra immediately said, you know, I'm coming over the next afternoon. We spent the whole afternoon together and basically told me that he would help cure our son. He was creating these tumor-specific targeted vaccines. And did I have any DNA? And I said, well, actually, you could have Jackson's eye. He doesn't want it anyway. He's having it removed. But unfortunately, they couldn't use an eye that had already been irradiated. So we were able to get him a small tissue sample, actually a pico unit, which I didn't even know was smaller, a thousandth of a nano unit, and able to identify from that 13 neopeptides or neoantigens and 13 peptides that they were able to make this vaccine. And Jackson started on the vaccine in June. And so, Jackson, I'm going to throw it to you. How are you feeling now?
Thanks, Mom. I'm feeling so hopeful and grateful for everything, for all these opportunities that I'm given. Thank you, Ezra, and all of the teams here at UCSD. It's truly spectacular. I mean, you know, it's basically I was given, you know, not very good chances, you know, not very good odds. They were saying basically, you know, here's a 90% chance or so that you're going to metastasize. And at that point it's over. But, you know, this really has given me a new lease on life pretty much. And I'm just so grateful. And it's hard to express my gratitude in just words, but it's truly amazing. I mean, you're saving my life, and hopefully this research can save countless others. It's so wonderful. Thank you, Ezra. And thank you, everyone at this team.
I want to thank both of you for sharing your amazing story with us. Now we have some time for some questions and answers. First, we have a question about immunotherapy and radiation therapy and reproductive abilities. Sounds like a good one for Jody.
Great. Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you so much. Jackson and Deanna, thank you again for being here. And, you know, like Ezra had told you earlier, we learn and we can only help patients because of you. And so, you know, as much as a gratitude we have for each other. So thank you for being so brave and for being here with us. So in terms of immunotherapy and fertility, I think it's a great question, Vice Chancellor Brenner, because as we use immunotherapy, and as many of us, you know, on the call know, you know, patients, advocates, researchers, a lot of immunotherapy and the clinical trials start with patients with locally advanced disease or metastatic disease. But as immunotherapy starts to become more a forefront of cancer therapeutics, then we start to move into earlier settings. And that at times can also mean in potentially younger patients. And so patients who undergo cytotoxic chemotherapy and radiation, we often talk to patients about fertility and how we can help them with their fertility goals. Right now, with immunotherapy, there is not a lot of data, long-term data, with fertility. And so right now, on clinical trials or off of the clinical trial setting, in patients who are getting immunotherapy, we ask that they use contraceptive devices and also that they not, you know, get pregnant for even 6 months after. So I think over time, you know, we'll start to learn more through clinical trials and patients who are able to help us with understanding immunotherapy effects on fertility. I think there can be, you know, multifold questions. And one of them is the side effects of immunotherapy can affect the endocrine system, you know, in more than 10 to 15% of patients. And so that can have a long-term effect on fertility or on, you know, ovaries and spermatogenesis. And then long-term, it could be the effect of the drugs themselves. So I think experts in the field are very hopeful that we can somewhat, you know, have it all in the sense that patients' quality of life, you know, prolonging disease-free intervals, increasing cures, but we still have to learn more.
Thank you so much. All right, here's one. I don't know whether Ed is going to like this or not. It just came up on the screen. How much does these personalized vaccines cost?
Yeah, we get asked that a lot.
Yeah, I thought you would.
and you know, for the right reasons, because we are entering a new paradigm in how we treat cancer and how we think about cancer. And as we enter any novel area or technology, the costs are going to be high up front. You know, think about how much your first personal computer costs. And how slow it was. Think about how much the first cell phone cost and how big it was. And of course, as those technologies advance, they come down. What we're really doing, though, with this is creating a treatment for one person at a time, and that would only serve that person. And if you think about it, that's what cancer is telling us. Cancer biology is a disease that where every cancer is unique at the molecular level. So ignoring that biology really has not served us well. And fortunately, now we have the technology to be able to decipher the differences between people's cancer at the molecular level, no longer at just the microscope. And of course, the immune system is very sophisticated, and we have the technology to understand that. That's a very long-winded way of saying that it is not cheap to create the vaccine because of the way that we're doing it. In real numbers, it costs anywhere from about $125,000 to $150,000 for each person. Now, that sounds like a lot of money, and it is. However, when put into the perspective of other cancer therapies, it actually is fairly, it would be cost effective if it worked. To put it into perspective of other immunotherapies, pembrolizumab, the drug that was mentioned earlier, costs about $13,000 a month, $13,000 to $15,000 a month. So if a patient's on that for a year, that's over $100,000. Many drugs are like that. That's not the exception. That tends to be the rule. And again, as we learn more about this personalized or individualized approach, the cost will come down. But right now, it is admittedly expensive. Thanks, David.
I have another one for Ezra. I actually want to know the answer to this. So what is the process of getting an immunotherapy treatment like by a practical perspective? Is it an injection? Is it done as an outpatient? How long are patients typically receiving treatments?
Well, it depends on the immunotherapy. Many of them are intravenously administered. Some of them are oral. In fact, one of the medicines that we used for Ricky Rocket, the gentleman I showed you in the picture, one of the drugs was oral in combination with an IV. Many of them are still in clinical trials. And so I'll urge the audience, and my guess is some of them involved in some sort of cancer care right now, either as a caregiver or as a patient, I would urge the audience to seek out clinical trials, because not only is that the way we move the field forward, but now there's real evidence that patients on clinical trials actually do better. They survive longer. And so we're still learning about how to use immunotherapy and how to best develop it. Many of the agents, in fact, are given through an injection. Some of them are oral, not yet any of them transdermal or anything like that, but many of them in clinical trials. And I'd again stress that people should try to take advantage of those. Thanks, David. Jody, I'm not sure if you had anything else to add to that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just, reiterate and emphasize that we have a really wonderful clinical trial office at UCSD Moores Cancer Center. Echoing again what Ezra has said, that we are indebted to our patients on clinical trials. It's how we move science forward. It's how we move care forward. And more than that, patients, even by the National Cancer Institute guidelines and the NCCN that Ezra so nicely alluded to, patients get better quality on a clinical trial. We almost have a whole team of patients looking after you, as well as your physician team, nurses, social workers. So we want to best support you during your cancer therapy. And a lot of that occurs through a clinical trial.
Jody, there were several questions about meditating and whether or not this is available to just your patients or to other cancer patients, and is there a website? There are several questions related to that, so maybe you can expand on that, please.
Yes. Well, you know, Vice Chancellor Brenner and to the audience, I thank you so much for that question. As we are oncologists and physicians, we recognize that the immune system is fighting infections, disease, cancer throughout our entire lives. And a lot of times we actually don't even know it. We are faced with viruses and pathogens since we've been little babies. And over time, our own immune system has amazing amounts of an ability to keep ourselves healthy. And in so doing, you know, over the course of several decades, medicine in general has found that, you know, not only can you have, you know, stress reduction, advantages to cardiovascular systems, but that a lot of times we have to take a step back and have a lot of self-care. And so at Moores Cancer Center, and I've been had the honor to participate in our support groups and networks to help patients, caregivers, and really all across the spectrum in terms of involvement of Moores Cancer Center staff. And so to get at your question, we do have an open Zoom meeting every Tuesday at 3 to 3:40 p.m. And we have deep breathing. We go through visualization, meditation, and we invite all of you to participate. It would be an honor to have you on the Zoom call. Kristen can maybe send out a link to everyone regarding how you can register. And we would love to have you on that relaxation technique course.
Yeah, we'll make sure they get a link. That's perfect. Thank you. Another question for Jody was, if you treat with a combination of immunotherapy and radiation, what does it do for side effects? Is it worse or better or combination of two? How does that work?
Yeah. And so, you know, in general, we know that radiation has its own profile of side effects. And, you know, over time, radiation therapists and oncologists have tried to, you know, either through dose reductions in radiation or decreasing the radiation field size, we could potentially decrease the side effect profile. Now, this question is very good because it looks at how can we use multimodality therapy to mitigate and decrease side effects that might have been caused by one modality. And so right now, say for example, with cervical cancer, we use a combination of radiation therapy and chemotherapy to cure most patients with cervical cancer. What we don't know right now is, can we potentially decrease the radiation dose? Could we decrease the field or the size of the amount of the body that we're radiating and maybe add on immunotherapy? And these are questions and discoveries that we want to make in the future. So right now, to a quick answer to that question is that if you combine radiation and immunotherapy, there are changes in the side effect profiles. But over time, we might be able to use some of your own immune system or immunotherapy to decrease the risk and the side effects of radiation by maybe decreasing the dose or decreasing the amount of the body that we need to radiate. And all of these things are on the horizon.
That's great. Thank you. All right. Here's a fun question. Probably the answer is not known, but I want to know what you guys think. Since immunotherapy boosts your immune system, does it make you less likely to get COVID-19 or other infections?
There's actually been some studies on this.
Really? Wow. Okay.
So the data would suggest that you are not more or less likely to get the infection. So exposure is not affected by being on immunotherapy. And although there's some controversy, the most recent data and the largest data set would suggest that patients on most of the immunotherapies that we're talking about actually don't have a worse outcome if they're infected with COVID-19. So there doesn't seem to be a negative interaction there. But again, there's some controversy. But the advice I give patients is, look, you have to be careful. You have to take the precautions, just like everybody else. And in fact, it more so because you are exposed to other things just in your just coming to the infusion center or getting your treatment or seeing your physicians. And you just have to be careful. But it doesn't seem like immunotherapy has a negative impact on COVID-19, which is at least good to report.
So do you want to add something about radiation therapy? Are you more susceptible to infections after radiation?
You know, I agree with Ezra. And right now, we don't think that radiation, you know, would make the COVID-19 infection worse. You know, we have been, as many of you on the call know, you know, UCSD has taken a lot of precautions with COVID, and particularly at Moores Cancer Center, Dr. Cohen has kind of spearheaded a lot of those initiatives. And so we practice, you know, very safe approaches with our patients right now. I think the bottom line that we want to, you know, let patients know is that, you know, often cancer is still going on during COVID, and we're taking a lot of precautions so that we can treat patients' cancer in a safe manner.
There are a couple of questions about what does insurance cover? Does insurance cover radiation therapy? Does it cover immunotherapy? If you do the two together, do they get covered? So I have no, I can't help you. You guys are on your own for this one.
You know, this is a big deal. I mean, patients, they often come to us and they say, you know, I'm about to lose my insurance, or, you know, right now I'm out of work because of the COVID crisis. And these are really amazing questions. I mean, a lot of times Ezra and all of our colleagues at Moores Cancer Center focus in on curing patients and research and clinical trials. And there's a whole side of taking care of patients that includes, I become unemployed. You know, I can't afford this cancer therapy. Is my insurance gonna pay for this? And these questions are so important because these are the nitty gritty. This is how you get food on the table. And so we do have whenever you come to visit us or, you know, your doctor at Moores Cancer Center, we do have a social worker who can help with this. But in general, with radiation therapy, you know, if there's an indication for you to have radiation, it is usually ubiquitously covered by your insurance, and we will, you know, work with you on that regard. In terms of therapies that are novel, you know, new, things on a clinical trial, often a clinical trial, when you sign up for the clinical trial, we will help you navigate that system. So, you know, a lot of times the novel agents or immunotherapies can be covered by the clinical trial. So these are ways that sometimes patients can be treated with a novel therapy that is interesting and exciting. And so every case is a little bit different, but in general, you know, FDA approved therapies are usually always covered by insurance. Ezra, I'm sure you have a lot of experience.
Yeah, so I showed that slide of the different cancers where immunotherapy has been approved. As a general rule, if it has been FDA approved, it will be covered by insurance. In fact, there are even patient assistance programs that we often utilize where there is no approval, but there are data to suggest benefit, and we appeal to patient assistance programs to provide the drug. So I would say for the most part, the agents are covered, and certainly if they're FDA approved, they're going to be covered by insurance.
Then there was a series of questions like, what type of cancers are being considered for immunotherapy? And some of the questions included, for example, metastatic cancers, are they being considered? And there was a specific question about because you only talked about cancer so far, about non-Hodgkin's lymphomas.
Yeah, so the simple answer is every cancer right now is being explored with immunotherapy. We really have entered a new age in cancer treatment. Immunotherapy's made us think differently about cancer. It certainly changed the treatment paradigms for many cancers. In terms of the specifically the personalized neoantigen vaccine, the principle there is that cancer is a disease of mutations, and because of that, every cancer is targetable with this approach. And we've actually looked at now probably over a dozen different cancer types and have been able to identify neoantigens and T cells that are targeting those neoantigens in every patient that we've looked at. So the immune system, it's nice because it doesn't care what type of cancer you have. It just cares that it's different. And if we can find a way to stimulate that, we can use immunotherapy.
There was a specific question about metastatic prostate cancer. What's the role for immunotherapy and what's the role for radiation therapy?
Yeah, let me take the immunotherapy first. Ironically, one of the first immunotherapies, certainly the first immunotherapy vaccine, therapeutic vaccine, not preventative, therapeutic vaccine was approved for prostate cancer. And it's still approved. It's still available, although admittedly not widely used. So there is a role for immunotherapy in prostate cancer, just like in every cancer. It depends on the individual. It depends on the specific setting. It depends on the cancer. With some of the drugs that we've been talking about, prostate cancer does not seem to respond very well, although there are exceptions for sure to that. But we're developing new treatments all the time for prostate cancer, new therapies, immunotherapies for prostate cancer, understanding what it takes to trigger the immune system to attack it. And we're actually recently seeing some very interesting results with different experimental immunotherapies. I'll let Joy get off.
Yes. So with prostate cancer and radiation, you know, radiation has, as many of you know on the call, a longstanding history of curing prostate cancer. For patients with metastatic prostate cancer, you know, we often think of metastatic prostate cancer into what we call hormone refractory or hormone sensitive. And if patients, you know, kind of go through the pathways of systemic therapy, and they have metastatic prostate cancer, often radiation can be used to help patients' symptoms. And so, you know, if there's a painful bony metastasis or even the prostate cancer itself can be treated with radiation and it's quite effective.
And believe it or not, there's a question for me, so you guys can rest, okay? They want to know what was up with, this has nothing to do with you. There's a question about COVID-19 and what's going on at UC San Diego Health, which you can certainly contribute to if you like. But there is some good news. I mean, as we do the PCR testing, there's been a downward trend for the last 2 weeks, you know, fewer positive tests. And as we look at the hospitalizations, it's been a slow downward trend. We were at 50, 55 patients with COVID-19 in both hospitals combined for the last couple of weeks. It's slowly drifted down into the 40s. So the trend is in the right direction. We are gearing up, though, to be able to offer COVID-19 testing on demand. That pretty much anyone in the patient or in the health system or a student or a faculty member or staff that wants to be tested will be able to be tested. We've really been very lucky to be able to combine our skills in clinical laboratories with the research interest to use robotics, use high-throughput PCR machines and other things to make the tests more efficient and less expensive, which has made it more available. One of the issues, I am actually not nearly as concerned about the testing itself as I am about the follow-up. One of the things I'm concerned about is the ability to do contact tracing and to efficiently do that, and then to quarantine people who have been exposed and to follow up with them. You know, as compared to many other Western countries, we do not have the same public health infrastructure that's part of the culture. And so we're really doing this from scratch. And we're getting help from the New School of Public Health. We're getting help from volunteers. But we're to some extent on our own. We also offer the antibody test. We use it more for public health epidemiology than we do for individuals. We don't know what to tell you if you're IgG antibody positive. We don't know if you're protected and if you are protected for how long. But we does give us an understanding of what the prevalence has been in our community. It's running about 1% positive, which, as we test people, it's about 1% positive. There have been some changes in the care. People are probably familiar with this, but putting patients prone seems to be able to support their respiration better than the traditional way of being supine. Some of the ventilator settings have been changed. The need for prolonged ventilation and be able to get off it has been shown, and we don't know the long-term sequelae of having survived it. So there's a lot of work to do, but at least some optimism about, you know, good public health discipline combined with good medical care that we seem to be weathering this. And then the $64,000 question is, what happens when students go to school? What happens when our college students come back? For the medical students, we feel really good about. For what we're doing preclinical, we're doing it all online. The small groups, the lectures, it's all online. For the clinical, they're being treated like any other colleague. You know, they wear the appropriate PPE, they're around, and they're back on the wards like any other physician. So we're metastable, and And thank you for that question. And I actually got, while I was talking, I got several more. So if we go really fast, we can answer some more questions. Okay. They're for me. The last question, and then we have to stop and don't talk. The last question about the luau. I apologize, my colleague. I stole your time. It's going to be virtual. We're not going to have a luau, unfortunately. We're not going to have a surfing contest. So I'm so disappointed. It's one of the, I don't know how long you guys have been here, but it's one of the great events that makes UC San Diego unique. They couldn't do that in Chicago or Cleveland. So so this is really, but I'm disappointed. But for Ezra and I, who can't surf, this is as close as we're going to get to surfing. So that will be that. All right, so we are done. I want to thank everyone, particularly Jody and Ezra, and also Deanna and Jack. That was incredible. Thank you so much for sharing your story. That really made this meeting. So thank you so much for that. And we had a great attendance. And if there are other questions that we did not get to, I'm going to promise, I have nothing to do with this, that Jody and Ezra will answer your questions. We'll get them back to you by line. What do you think of that? Okay, thank you so much. I'm going to sign off now, and it was a pleasure to spend the afternoon with you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.